agnostics, long-haired weirdos, short-haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans.
Love the government, hug the government, love the government, hug the government, love the government.
Welcome to The Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Michael Baranowski, professor of political science at Northern Kentucky University. I'm joined today by my conservative counterpart, Cleveland area attorney and defender of freedom, Jay Carson. Hey, Jay.
Hey, Mike.
How are you doing this week?
Well, it's Friday, so I'm pretty good now. We're recording a little earlier than we usually do.
For those of you who are expecting Kristen and not Jay, Kristen will be back next week. Actually, we have her on the schedule now. We are looking forward to having her back, though I'm always happy to be doing the show with Jay. Also, before we get started, we'd like to thank our newest supporters, Jim, Jonathan, Sean, Nick, Gary, Joseph, and Billy. It's weird, Jay. There always seem to be more new supporters on weeks that Trey and Kent are doing the show as opposed to us. I'm trying not to take that personally. Anyway, also, Wilmer, thank you for a very generous donation to the show through Venmo. That's, of course, on top of Wilmer's already generous monthly sustaining support. You are one of the truly great ones, and we really appreciate it. And, of course, when you're a Patreon supporter, you get that second full-length episode every week. You get ad-free versions of all our shows, other stuff as well. Check it out. Go to patreon.com/politicsguys. And if you like that stuff, but you can't afford to support the show right now, send me an email, mike@politicsguys.com, and I'll get you set up. And if your RSS feed is broken for that bonus show and you're not a Patreon supporter, there was a little technical issue. I had to switch some things up. Just send me an email, and I will get you reset up in that whole process. All right. So today we will be talking about the Gaza ceasefire, the push for an independent commission on the January 6th Capitol takeover, the possibility of the Supreme Court overturning Roe versus Wade just before the 2022 midterm elections, and maybe even more. We'll see how time goes. But before we get to that, we will take that first quick break, and we will be right back to start things off. Okay, Jay, so our top story today is the 11-day conflict in the Gaza Strip is, well, if not at a not an end, certainly at least at a halt, I would say, with both Israel and Hamas agreeing to an Egyptian-brokered ceasefire. And the thousands of rockets that were launched by Hamas, the majority of which were blocked by Israel's Iron Dome defense system, resulted in at least a dozen Israeli deaths, with Israeli retaliatory strikes against Gaza killing over 230 Palestinians, so a nearly 20 times greater death toll on the Palestinian side. Both sides declared victory after the ceasefire, and in Israel, the far right expressed disappointment that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu agreed to halt military action at this point. Now, President Biden, who initially hung back on calling for a ceasefire, but eventually did so on Wednesday, said that he sees this as a genuine opportunity toward building a lasting peace in the Middle East. In a statement, the president said, "I believe the Palestinians and Israelis equally deserve to live safely and securely and enjoy equal measures of freedom, prosperity, and democracy. My administration will continue our quiet, relentless diplomacy toward that." Many people on the progressive left feel that Biden didn't put enough pressure on Israel, calling the treatment of Palestinians in Gaza apartheid. Support for Israel, which not too long ago was a matter of really strong bipartisan agreement, has, like so many other things, become a lot more politicized in the U.S. in recent years. Of course, it wasn't helped by Benjamin Netanyahu embracing former President Trump and, you know, many on the left, I think, being increasingly sympathetic to the plight of Palestinians in the occupied territories. So, Jay, last week, Trey and Ken talked about this situation with the focus more on Netanyahu's domestic political reasons for the response we saw. They've sort of been our Israeli politics correspondents for a while now on the show. And so I thought we could maybe take a look more at the U.S. political context. So what's your initial take on all this?
Well, I think the first thing I'd want to say in response to you said that there are more on the left have grown more sympathetic to the Palestinians. I think it's a matter of not that there has been a change in sympathy, but there's been a change in personnel. You know what I mean? There are more elected Democrats who hold sort of an antipathy towards Israel than were present, say, 5-10 years ago. So I think it's less that the ideas or the where individual members are is moving as opposed to just different members, and that's you have a different caucus than what you did a decade ago. That said, I mean, from my perspective, I was initially heartened by Biden's response and his defense of Israel's right to defend itself, which I think was entirely appropriate. At some point, you knew that the U.S. would join the chorus of "Let's have a ceasefire," and eventually they did. Now, my hope, I mean, would be that to some extent we're doing this in coordination with Israel, our ally. Obviously, I don't know one way or the other. But to start with, I would say I was heartened by U.S. support of Israel against Hamas, which is a terrorist organization funded by Iran, and. You know, I think we ought to be able to take a clear side on that. So, that's where I guess my starting point. Is there also something in there is Hamas testing Biden? My sense is maybe, right, but that's probably like a little farther down the line. I think we have a tendency here in the United States to think that a lot of foreign events are related to. Do what we do or think, and they aren't necessarily. That's not necessarily so. So as Kay and Trey and Ken talked about, there being some domestic Israeli issues going on. I think there are also some domestic Palestinian issues. In that, I think Hamas would like to be seen as the stronger anti-Israel government as opposed to the government of the Palestinian Authority. So I think there's that going on as well. That's my opening thoughts there on the.
You know, I have a lot of sympathy for regular the Palestinian people. Let's say that the situation there on the ground is really awful, and I think everyone can agree that. I mean, destroyed infrastructure even before this, decaying infrastructure, rampant COVID. Unemployment is somewhere around 70%. It's a horrible situation for the Palestinian people who are being, I think it's fair to say, misruled by this terrorist government or government. I use the term very loosely. And I think everyone believes that Palestinian lives matter and that the treatment of Palestinian, that their life situation is, for most of them, is truly awful. And I'm sure you don't disagree with that.
No, not at all. And again, I think you hit the nail on the head in that, look, this is the Palestinians have been governed to the extent you can use that word by sort of a corrupt kleptocracy for years, whose main goal was, you know, hatred and inflaming hatred of Israel. And as a result, you know, peace has been elusive, and I think that's part of the situation that the Palestinians are in. So, I have a great deal of sympathy for Palestinian people, and just as you might say that, look, you could have a great deal of sympathy for, the Japanese people or the German people in World War II, but that. That doesn't change what's going on as a military issue, right? I mean, it's I do believe, and again, this will probably get me in trouble, but my belief is sincere that I don't think the Israelis intentionally target civilians. Hamas does. Hamas has been known also to use people as human shields. And again, that's beyond disturbing, but it is what it is. And
And I think Hamas does that because they want that, in a sense, they want the civilians to be targeted so they can wave the bloody shirt and say, yeah. look what Israel's doing. And that, but at the same time, I do. I agree with most of the rest of the world that the West Bank settlements are illegal, that it is occupied territory, not disputed lands, as the term of art in Israeli politics is, I guess. And not only that, but that the intended purpose of the occupation and moving all the settlers in, which really, you know, ramped up since Netanyahu's been in power the last 12 years, is to make a two-state solution impossible. I believe that that's, you know, something that Netanyahu and those to the right of him certainly just have an abhorrence of, and they realize that these settlements is the best way to, you know, make that much more difficult. And but at the same time, I think it's important to understand or try to understand things from Israel's perspective. You know, there's this, it seems to me pretty clear that, you know, that the world, at least big parts of the world, actively are against Israel. Here's just to give you a sense of Sinjay.
Well, I'd say most everybody.
Since 2015.
I mean, going way back to the UN, you know, Zionism is racism resolution, you know, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and going back to millennia of anti-Semitism. But but just this one fact, I think, really encapsulates a lot. Since 2015, the UN Human Rights Council has issued zero condemnations for China, Pakistan, Venezuela, Cuba, or Zimbabwe, 6 for North Korea, 7 for the U.S., so we're one more than North Korea, 12 for Russia, and get ready, 112 for Israel.
I think, I don't know if I've said this on the show, but I've contended for years that's the entire purpose of the UN Human Rights Commission, which is a sham. It's to condemn Israel. That's what they're there for. That's
yeah. And
if you look at the countries that have been represented on the UN Human Rights Commission, it's
a joke.
Again, it's,
I mean,
it's,
it really...
it's shocking and stunning, and the idea that we would, and the US has been on and off in terms of how greatly we've condemned that, but it's a joke.
And here, this is why I'm so conflicted about this, because you see these scenes of how of life in these occupied territories, and it's awful. But then again, I don't see any way out of this, because given the fact that Hamas is clearly and vocally and loudly committed to the destruction of Israel, that's not the same as apartheid in South Africa or anything like that. I mean, that's why I reject that analogy, because I just don't think it's right. Israel does have a right to defend itself. And that's why I was glad when I heard that President Biden said he's going to make sure that Israel's Iron Dome defensive missiles are resupplied. Like, yeah, absolutely. We want to see that, because without that, the death toll, I mean, I mentioned that the death toll for the Palestinians was 20 times higher. But that's only because those Iron Dome rockets were able to shoot down, a vast majority of those 4,000 rockets that Hamas launched, and thank God for that. So,
I'm also always a little skeptical of numbers coming from the Palestinian side.
That's fair. But even if we assume those numbers,
we assume the numbers are double what or half of what they say, that there's still a tremendous disparity. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I think the problem is people say, well, because I know I'm going to get some heat on this, because certainly for you, this is it's a pretty standard position on the right.
Right.
But on
everybody
the left,
expects me to be where I am.
Right. I think I'm very much out of touch with certainly the progressive left on that. But I feel like it's a false dichotomy. I can be very much appalled by how things are for the Palestinians and want to do whatever we can to relieve their plight, but not necessarily say, well, you know, Israel is just has to do what? Just allow terrorism to run unchecked and not have these border checks? I mean, it's a crummy choice, but certainly an option is not for Israel to just say, well, you know, we're just going to give up. And so, okay, we're going to allow these folks who want to destroy us to move freely around in Israel. That's no option. And to me, this is sort of the inevitable result of simply creating a state in the middle of an extremely hostile environment, which, you know, was basically what was done with the creation of Israel in 1948. And I am absolutely in favor of a Jewish state, you know, but I'm also in favor of the right of that state to defend itself. And so that's why I think overall, my sense of the Biden administration's larger policy here is just to try to disengage as much as possible, as opposed to every president, certainly in our lifetimes, Jay, who've said, well, we're going to try to bring peace to the Middle East, and talk about a fool's errand.
Yeah. Yeah. And I just want to make a comment. This is just on a funny linguistic thing. But when we talk about Gaza as being the occupied territory, as I understand this recently, I read that there were like 30 some factories in Gaza building these missiles. Now, Gaza is about, again, roughly the you know, size of the greater Cleveland area, Cuyahoga County sort of area. I couldn't imagine having 30 missile facilities, in my county. That would be like the largest employer, by far. So if when people use the word, they say, oh, it's an occupied territory. Well, it's not terribly well occupied. If the other side is able to operate, build all these missiles and launch them, and have the infrastructure of the tunnels and all that. That's just my little kind of tweaking people and making kind of a linguistic point. But on the broader point, I think there are some other things that are going on, over the past, if we look way back, I say way back, I'm talking, 40 years, there has been a continual thaw between Israel and the Arab world, starting with Egypt, and then up through last year, where, again, these were countries that did not recognize Israel's right to exist. And upon whom the Palestinians had relied in large part for both financial, military, and moral support. And now they're sort of down to Hamas and Iran. So I think there is progress there. And I think peace is possible. We were very close to sort of a two-state solution back in the late 90s, early 2000s. But
Netanyahu
again,
took power. I think that he has done a lot to push things wrong direction.
Keep in mind, according to Bill Clinton's memoirs, it was the Palestinians who rejected the deal. And then Netanyahu came to power. And then you had the uprising of the early 2000s. So I think a two-state situation, it's been tried, it's been proposed so many times, and I think many Israelis would agree to it, would agree to a two-state solution, as long as there was not the guaranteed right to return, which has always also been the sticking point.
But I think now it's just not much of a possibility because of old settlements that have been built, and again, I believe they were built specifically to make that not possible. And I understand, at least to the extent that anyone living in a very secure, large military superpower can understand why that may have been the case, but it's also just makes it just a wickedly tough problem.
Yeah, no, I agree with you.
I feel frustrated because usually, Jay, I say, here's what I think we should do. I have some policy ideas and solutions, but honestly, I feel like, and this sounds like it's going to sound like a Republican talking point coming from me, but Israel is a flawed democracy. I think Netanyahu certainly seems like he's a corrupt SOB, but Israel is also the most democratic country in the region, and they have been an ally for a long time. And I think it is not only in our strategic interest, but I think it's a moral imperative for us to support democracy around the world. And so, about all I can offer, I guess, is to say, well, I think we should. I don't have a problem with the recently approved $735 million in arms sale to Israel, which is, entirely, I believe, for precision-guided munitions. Again, and also I'm in favor of the Iron Dome resupply for those missiles, because I think we need to support our allies. And but also, I guess the only other thing I could offer is, I think we need to work as much as possible as we can with the Palestinian Authority and try to supply aid, economic aid and other types of aid in ways that don't also support Hamas, and that's super difficult to do.
Well, I was going to say that's always the thing. We've been doing that for years of saying, well, we're going to provide aid to the Palestinians, and that aid ends up in as bombs in Israel.
Yeah. I mean, it's just I hate talking about this issue. I can't even imagine living it. I hate talking about it because I just find myself completely just at sea, you know, and it's a very frustrating sort of thing. But generally speaking, I feel like the Biden administration's approach has been pretty decent, actually. I get the sense that Joe Biden is much more for sort of quiet behind the scenes type of diplomacy. And I just like that as a contrast to what we saw the 4 years previous. But it seems to me he's navigating this reasonably well, given especially the pressures that he's facing from kind of his left flank in his own party.
Yeah. The other thing, I mean, to the extent that I would offer policy solutions, it is the policy solution that Netanyahu has offered. And that is look for there to be any peace to be possible. Hamas has to be wiped out.
And, I'm all for wiping out terrorist organizations. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that's got to be a starting point. And does that mean that we eventually, you know, get peace, you know, down the road? No, probably not. There are a whole lot of other hurdles to get through. But when you have a terrorist organization funded by a regional power that is seeking to expand, there's no way that, you know, a regional power that has sworn that it wants to, you know, push Israel into the sea. There's really no easy way to make peace with that kind of an enemy.
Yeah, agreed. All right, well, let's take a quick break, and then we will move right on to our next story. Everyone deserves nice things, but with all the markups in traditional luxury retail, high-quality goods can be awfully expensive. Quince is different. They're a one-stop shop for essential products with low design costs. They've got tees, hoodies, loungewear, pants and shorts, blouses, dresses, skirts. I mean, unless you're a nudist, they've got something for you. And, you know, even if you are clothing optional, they've got home accessories, bedding, bath, decor, all sorts of good stuff. Quince finds the best factories and only partners with those committed to the highest production standards, fair wages, safety, and sustainability, which is particularly a big deal to me. And because Quince is shipping directly to you with no agents, stores, or other middlemen, you get great 100% factory direct prices on everything. I mean, I've been desperately in need of some new t-shirts, and I was really impressed by the price and quality of their organic Pima cotton selection. And my bath towels, honestly, are looking pretty ratty, too. So Quince's great prices on high-quality Turkish bath towels, they really caught my eye. Quality shouldn't be a luxury. You deserve it. So try Quince today. Get free shipping and 365-day free returns by going to onequince.com/politicsguys. Many of their collections sell out immediately, so don't wait. You can save hundreds of dollars on clothing and accessories by going to onequince.com/politicsguys. That's onequince.com/politicsguys. Okay, Jay, so next let's talk about the House of Representatives approving this week a bipartisan commission to investigate the January 6th takeover of the U.S. Capitol. That bill actually passed the House 252-175, with 35 Republicans joining the House Democrats in support. Now, what's interesting about this, well, a lot of things are, but Republican Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy actually was the person to authorize his fellow Republican John Katko to negotiate a deal. And in a February letter to Speaker Pelosi, McCarthy said, you know, we're not going to do this unless there's equal representation from both parties. Well, that's exactly what the plan that Katko agreed to, a bipartisan plan, had. 10 members on the commission, 5 from each party, and the majority required to issue any subpoenas. I mean, it was modeled, taken directly from the 9/11 commission. But this week, after former President Trump came out strongly against the commission, calling it a Democrat trap, McCarthy announced his opposition, though he didn't go so far as to formally whip votes against the measure. It was more just like a strong encouragement, basically. And then in the Senate, Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, who initially expressed some openness considering the commission, also came out against it. So, Jay, what's your take on this? It seemed like it was something that, you know, there was, I mean, why in the world would McCarthy say, go ahead and, you know, basically, you know, make a deal for this and let's make sure it's bipartisan? Well, 5-5 and a majority to issue subpoenas, that seems about as bipartisan as it gets. So what's the problem here?
Well, I think a couple things. One, I think the Republicans are wisely seeing that this is a trap. And it makes sense for them to be on the record voting no at this point, so they can say down the road, look, we told you this is all just just political theater.
Can you explain what you mean by trap? I guess I'm confused about that.
Well, I mean, this is going to be the narrative that is going to be pushed is that this was, you know, Donald Trump's secret plan to overthrow the government. And that, you know, he directly, you know, incited this with an effort to essentially have a coup. That's based on the narrative we've seen so far.
I guess, Jay, before you go further, I guess I understand how there are plenty of Democrats who might argue that, though maybe not quite as an extreme version of that. But even if that is the case, I don't see how at least one Republican who, and by the way, these Republicans on this committee would be appointed by McCarthy and McConnell. I don't exactly see how they would sign on to that. So that's, I guess, where I'm confused about this. How it's the trap if the committee report could only be, I mean, the majority report of the committee could only be that, you know, as such, with at least one Republican handpicked by McConnell and McCarthy signing on. So what's the fear from that? What's the trap in that? I mean,
well, I guess, I mean, one, I'm not sure that you get that sign on, or that you don't end up with two separate reports, or the Democrats issuing their own report.
But so what?
Well, I mean,
it's not the committee report. I mean, the minority, they could issue reports right now and they would have absolutely no. That's the whole point of a bipartisan committee. I mean, Pelosi may end up making her own.
The whole point of the bipartisan committee is just to run these issues up a flagpole, right? And then you have Republicans who say, no, we can't sign on to that. And the Democrats say, look, we have exposed this coup. They will not even play with the commission. This is ridiculous. Here's our Democrat report highlighting the Trump's attempted coup. I'm not arguing one or the other, but again, just to be clear, I'm putting on my purely strategic thinking cap here. And at some point, Republicans are going to say this is a kangaroo court. And, you know, then
can you explain that term?
If they had voted for this, would have been, well,
can you
why
explain
did you,
the term?
You agree to it?
Kangaroo court. Pardon? Can you explain the term?
It is a fake proceeding, an unserious.
Okay, in what sense is it fake?
Well,
again, you're missing. I see. This is what I don't get, and I'm trying to understand. I believe you're arguing this in good faith, but again, there can be a minority report, which would mean nothing because it doesn't have the credibility of bipartisanship. And so, what I'm saying is that what do Republicans have to fear from any report that one or more of their handpicked members would sign on to? I don't think they have anything to fear from it. And, you know, back in February, plenty of Republicans were saying we need something modeled after the 9/11 commission. Well, this is that pretty much carbon copy in terms of structure. And now all of a sudden, well, it's duplicative. We don't need it. That to me just seems like they're saying, you know what? We know what's going on here. We don't want to get Donald Trump mad because Donald Trump is still incredibly powerful. So you know what? Let's just not have this investigation. It would just be really inconvenient to subpoena, you know, even potentially subpoena Kevin McCarthy and others. Not that there would be a majority vote on the committee to do that, but so let's just make this all go
away.
That
would be
pretend
the point.
It didn't happen.
Understand?
But it wouldn't happen.
That's
my point.
That's the point. No. It doesn't have to happen. It doesn't have to happen. It's you get the headline, right?
So you don't think Kevin McCarthy should be
the trap, right? This is why
the
typically
truth
Republicans,
is a trap. It is. It's a horrible trap.
No, please just listen here.
Okay.
Because Republicans are usually terrible at playing this inside baseball.
Oh, that's so that, you're so wrong. Go ahead.
But so no, the trap is, you say, we'd like to have a commission. Oh, sure, okay, we'll sign on to your commission. At which point, then they demand all sorts of witnesses. They demand to call. They're going to call Donald Trump. They will call every other members of the Trump administration. They will seek to do everything. They will call Bill Barr and say, didn't you know about this? How did you allow this? So then what happens is they will seek to call a lot of witnesses purely for the political spectacle of it. When Republicans object to that, say, listen, this is ridiculous. We won't sign on to that subpoena. They will then cry to the media, look, they're obstructing the investigation. This is exactly what we told you would happen.
But shouldn't we want to know what Kevin McCarthy, what his role was? And shouldn't we want to hear from some of these people? I mean, I sure think it would be helpful to know what Donald Trump knew and when he knew it and how he acted, and get people on the record before this committee saying what exactly the former president's response was and what McCarthy was saying. Isn't this valuable information? Doesn't the public have a right to know this?
Well, if so, I mean, maybe. But I'm not sure why you sign on to the commission. I mean, again, if there's any intrepid reporters out there, they can pick up the phone and call these people.
Intrepid
and
reporters
if they say no comment,
power?
Well, there you know something.
But that's the thing. There's a big difference, I'm sure you would agree, between an intrepid reporter from any organization calling and getting the brush off and actually being subpoenaed by a special committee.
Yeah.
And the
idea, again, you would get more into the attempted, perjury traps, that sort of thing.
Someone is called to testify and they lie. I mean, you can call it a perjury trap.
No. Perjury trap is let's think back to like the Scooter Libby. Tim Russert situation, right? Where he said one thing under oath, and then you had hearsay evidence that a reporter who was then dead said that he had said something different. And that's right. That's the perjury trap, right? Somebody says, look, I heard him say something different. I get why the Democrats are doing it, and I get why the Republicans would not want to play along with this.
I guess to me, the problem that I'm having is there were an awful lot of Republicans who in February and even in March were saying, yeah, we definitely should have this commission as long as it's even between Democrats and Republicans. And so Democrats called their bluff and said, okay, we'll make it even between Democrats and Republicans. And now, the biggest thing, I guess, that's credible that I hear, that's not just playing politics with this, is the argument that, well, this is too narrow. It should have been expanded to include investigation of left-wing violence last summer in Portland and other places. And, I say to that, these are two different issues, but fair enough. Okay, there was a lot of, anti-government violence and protests that were, caused a lot in property damage and deaths and so. So, yeah, let's investigate that, but we don't want to conflate these two things. And I would, if I were certainly in Congress, I would agree to a separate investigation on that. But it seems to me that Republicans basically, this is just my sense, is that back in February, they felt like they had to agree to something like this with no intention of ever going through with it because, well, I think the main reason for McCarthy, why he basically cut off Katko at the knees, was because he wants to be speaker come January 2023. And I think there's a really good chance of that happening. If I were a betting person, and I am, I would bet on that. But he knows that without sort of the Trumpist vote and support, that's not going to happen. And so that's why he did what he did. What do you think about that?
Do you think, I do want to mention is that the rules would allow the Democratic chairman to be in control of staff of the committee and also could demand unilaterally information from federal agencies without a subpoena. So there is that tilts the scales. But look, I'd be willing to say, okay, yeah, they have the majority, so they're gonna have more power on this. But do you think that the commission's purpose is to really get at what happened on January 6th, or do you think it is to embarrass and go after once more Donald Trump?
Both. And I think that's true of almost anything that happens in Congress, is there's always a political motive. But, you know, the fact of the matter is you and I both saw the pictures. We saw plenty of people running through the Capitol with members of Congress barricaded in there, running through the Capitol with Trump signs and Trump banners and hats and all that. And sure, it's going to embarrass Trump, because Donald Trump indirectly, I don't believe that he directly incited this, but certainly he was the cause, the indirect cause of this more than any other individual. Will that be embarrassing? Yeah, and it should be embarrassing, because it was what is just about the most disgraceful political act I can think of in my lifetime. So yeah, I think he should be embarrassed. Of course, he's past embarrassment, but yeah.
Right. But what do you think that, what will what information do you think is going to come out though?
Well, you know, I don't know. That's why we have hearings. You could say the same thing about,
but
I don't know.
Look, we also have criminal investigations going on.
That's very different. That's about discreet acts.
400 some arrests and you know, people waiting prosecution.
But that's a different thing. That's very focused on specific acts of individuals. That's a very different thing. I mean, you know, yes, I know this is all very political, because, you know, there are plenty of Republicans in Congress who would have had, you know, 100 investigations of Benghazi. And all of a sudden now, you know, just turning their heads with an actual, you know, insurrection at the Capitol. And so that to me is, well, that's just politics, sure. But, you know, the role of Donald Trump,
I guess,
in this,
here's the difference. Here's my, I point out the difference between something like Benghazi. Is Benghazi, there was sort of a mystery there, right? How did this happen? Because we were told one thing by the administration, that it was, oh, it's just because this video. But then we learned that there were other things going on. There were also questions about why troops weren't sent in to support the embassy at Benghazi. Here, what's the mystery?
Great question. And the answer, you just mentioned there was a mystery of why troops weren't sent in. Well, one big mystery about the Capitol issue is exactly when Donald Trump knew what was going on and how he reacted and what he called for. And there seems to be a certain amount of evidence suggesting that this happened and he was kind of just sort of gleefully watching it on Fox News and actually egging some of these people on when, you know, the Capitol was being literally invaded. And if that doesn't turn any real patriotic American stomach, I think there's something wrong with that person.
It does. But okay, so to what extent does it, I think why weren't reinforcements sent in? Why wasn't the National Guard called earlier? I think those are important questions to look at. And Congress has already taken testimony on that. But I guess you sort of hit on the point of, well, what was Donald Trump doing? I think that's pretty clear, right? I wouldn't dispute anyone who says he was just sitting there watching people cheer it on. And I think that is disgraceful. But the plan is to just replay it again. And I get that. It's a political move, and the Republicans are responding with a political move. And the idea is, I guess maybe the best way to explain this is, if you have a supposedly bipartisan commission, the idea is that there is some modicum of legitimacy and fairness built into that, as opposed to just a regular investigation by a House committee or a Senate committee.
Right.
And I think Republicans don't want to play into that because they think they're not going to actually. It's going to be the same as if it was just a regular House committee or Senate committee investigation, and they're just not going to play along. So,
Except it wouldn't, because in a regular investigation, Democrats would have the majorities and would have sole power to subpoena or to allow or disallow the other side to call witnesses.
Right, but again, my point is that the point is not to find any new information. The point is to be able to call witnesses who the Republicans will have to object to, and then point the finger for objecting.
The point
is to get headlines.
So basically you're saying that both sides on this are acting entirely in bad faith and no one really gives a damn about actually finding out anything. Is that more or less it?
Yes. I think people know what happened. Now, again, there are, I think, the legitimate questions about where was the National Guard and, you know, why not earlier and who called that off, whether it was Trump, whether it was DC, all that. Let me flip the question on you. Suppose there was an investigation of left-wing violence. And Democrats said, no, we're not going to sign on to this to be part of this commission. How would you feel? What would your response be?
Well, I think my response would obviously depend on what sort of violence. If we're talking specifically about the stuff.
Like the protests of May 25th.
Yeah, I
Black Lives Matter protests, continually trying to burn down the courthouse in Portland, pretty much every other Friday. That type of left-wing violence.
If I were in Congress, I certainly would be okay with an investigation of that. I mean, it was pretty widespread. It was a huge thing, and I don't see any problem with that. I just say it shouldn't be.
Mr. Chairman, my first witness I'd like to call is Congressman Maxine Waters.
Sure, absolutely. Why not?
Well, you might allow it, but I don't think. I don't think the actual participants would.
Well, let me ask you this. I guess I'm saying that you're saying there's no one who I'm saying, and I think you believe this, that I am approaching this and with good faith. And
yeah.
You're saying that there is literally no one in Congress on either side who is approaching this with any good faith at all.
I'm not going to go out and say there's literally no one in Congress who is approaching this in good faith, but I think both sides recognize this is a political game, and
sure,
it is much more aimed at generating headlines and politics in the run-up to off-year elections than it is to getting any actual new information.
Okay, that's, you know, I don't actually think we're as far apart as maybe I initially thought we were. I think it's just that, you know, you tend to be, I think, much more on the cynical side, and I'm a bit more idealistic on these things. But yeah, I certainly can't disagree with that. Anyone who says that that's not a major element of this from both sides is, I think, incredibly naive. So I think where we differ is the extent to which this could be useful for anything aside from those political purposes. And I think I see it as having more use, if for nothing else, to just, well, and this would be bad for Republicans in the short run, but I think better for them in the long run. Anything we can do to point out to the American public in as bipartisan a way as possible what a complete disaster of a president Donald Trump was, and how his sort of authoritarian, anti-conservative, anti-democratic politics should never be the model for the Republican Party going forward, I think that's a good thing.
But there's always the question of, will you renounce Donald Trump and all his works? Right? And they're always this, you have to say it, renounce him. And you don't get that coming on the right. But I don't understand exactly what where the differences are in terms of why that tends to be a thing of the public renouncement. But that's,
I think it's because of Donald Trump. I mean, Donald Trump explicitly called, you know, he's lied, I think you agree, in a way about the legitimacy of the 2020 election, and that
absolutely
indirectly.
Yeah.
So that's why he needs to be renounced in a way that no other politician, American politician, at least no other American president before him, ever needed to be renounced, not just for the sake, I would argue, of the Democratic Party or the Republican Party, but for the sake of democracy in America.
Bill Clinton lied to a federal court, right? We renounce Bill Clinton and all his works.
They're different categories of lie, Jay, and I think you know that.
One was under oath to a federal judge.
That's not the difference I'm talking about, and I think you know that as well. The difference is that Donald Trump's repeated lies struck at the very heart of a democracy in a way that Bill Clinton's didn't. I certainly denounce Bill Clinton's lies. I'll denounce any president's lies. But there are different there are different weights, there are different consequences of different lies. And this lie, I think, strikes the repeated big lie of Donald Trump that we see the repercussions of now in Arizona and other places with these crazy audit ninja people and all that, that is going to have ramifications, that has ramifications for, you know, God knows how long, that strikes again at the heart of this democracy. That's a lot different than saying, well, I didn't have sex with that woman, which, hey, not good, but a whole different thing.
I guess you miss my point. I'm okay. Saying I agree with you 100% that what Trump has done, he is indirectly responsible through the big lie. Again, assuming the big lie, because we talked about this to some extent, I think there's still good reason to believe that Trump is just delusional when he actually believes he won the election by a landslide. I think that's you know how I read the transcript of the Georgia call. But regardless, I guess when do people get to stop renouncing Trump? When never. Will this? Let me put it this way. Exactly, because here we are at the end of May, and who are we still talking about?
Well, because right? Donald Trump is still driving the agenda of the Republican Party.
Well,
Kevin McCarthy,
to some extent, I guess,
he's the most powerful, the most prominent Republican in the country, and he will be for years to come. So, yes, absolutely, he needs to be denounced. He needs to be shamed, denounced. He needs to be dragged through every kind of legitimate mud that he possibly can be to make anyone who even thinks about going down the same anti-democratic path that he attempted to go down, to make sure that is not a possibility going forward. That's why this is so critically important.
Do you think it helps or hurts democracy?
It would help
as a
if
whole.
Some Republicans got on board, that's for sure. If it doesn't help, yeah, if it's all Democrats, sure. No, not at all.
Yeah. I mean,
so that's why I have a problem with the revive. And I understand. Let me be clear. I understand the Republican dilemma here, because what I am in effect asking Republicans to do is to say, you know what? I need you to destroy part of your base in the short term to save your party and democracy in the long term. And a lot of people, I mean, every Republican office holder is a short term, especially in the House, by definition person. They're saying, well, that's not a deal I'm interested in taking. You know, I get it. I get the political calculation, but I think it's disastrous for our country.
Well, or what if you had plenty of Republicans who are willing to let's just move on, right? Let's talk about the problems we have now. Let's talk about how do we come into the post-pandemic economy? How do we deal with the spending promises we've made? How do we deal with potential inflation? How do we deal with China and Russia? Is there some room for that? But the Democrats would still like to keep talking about Donald Trump forever.
Sure. And I see what you're saying, that there's absolutely that political advantage. And I think you're right.
Look, if I'm the Republicans and I'm talking about Donald Trump, I'm losing, right? That's wasted air that I'm not able to push on some other agenda.
I get how it's frustrating.
I'm not saying you're wrong. I'm just saying recognize that part of this is a game, right?
Yeah. Absolutely. I don't disagree with you on that. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. All right. Well, you know, Jay, let's just
one last thing.
Yeah, go ahead.
One last
thing.
So you're a big Steelers fan, right?
Uh-huh.
And
this is Ben Jay Roethlis- trying to torpedo my Ohio U.S. Senate campaign before
exactly.
It even
begins. That's going to do it right there. Listen, so in the past, Ben Roethlisberger has been credibly accused of rape.
Mm-hmm.
If you were at a Steelers boosters party, right, and you're there, and someone keeps calling and demanding on you, Mike, or how about this? You're president of the local Cincinnati Steelers Boosters Club. And people keep demanding of you, Mike, as the president of the club, we demand that you come out and renounce Ben Roethlisberger as a rapist.
Well, I would say, you know, he has a presumption of innocence, and he has not been, he is not actually a convicted rapist. So I get what you're saying, Jay.
But the point is not to do anything that really has anything to do with Roethlisberger. The point is to embarrass you.
I don't I get what you're saying. And so, I don't disagree with you. I just feel that the scope of what Donald Trump, the wrongness that he injected into this is just so great that, it, you know, and sure, that sounds like it's a very convenient thing for me as a Democrat to say, and it is, I'll admit that. So, yeah, there you go. All right, let's just take one more quick break, and then we will be back and talking about another, totally not at all contentious issue, the possible end of Roe versus Wade. Ooh, just in time for the 2022 midterms as well. Okay, Jay, so our final story today, the Supreme Court announced this week that it would hear Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization, a challenge to Mississippi's law that would, well, with limited exceptions, ban abortions after the 15th week of pregnancy. Now, after Mississippi passed this law in 2018, Jackson Women's Health Organization, which is the only licensed abortion provider in the state, challenged it, as you would expect. As the law was a very straightforward violation of the Supreme Court's precedent of not allowing abortion bans before fetal viability, which usually is right around 24 weeks, both the federal district and appeals courts struck down the law. Now, the issue that the Supreme Court will be ruling on is whether all pre-viability prohibitions on elective abortions are unconstitutional. And the case will be heard in the 2021-22 term, which begins in October of this year. And it's typical for major rulings to be announced at the end of the term, which would be somewhat time around June or so of 2022, which is, you know, pretty in the run-up to the 2022 midterm elections. So, Jay, first off, I guess I want to get your sense of why you think the court might have taken this case and any sense of how you think it might rule, or if we can tell at this point.
Well, they need four to take it. And I think you just got Amy Coney Barrett. I think that's part of it. You can also say, listen, the court hasn't taken a major abortion case in quite a while. There have been these here and there ones that were typically went to some extraneous, whether it produced an undue burden on the woman, as opposed to going at the core of is this a constitutional right or not? I think it's big. That said, I'm still not sure you're going to get a complete overturn, or you might get Roe versus Wade overturned, but yet modified. For example, I think there's a good argument to say that Casey, in fact, you know, really overturned Roe versus Wade. So I don't know. I hate to hazard a guess again, especially at this point where the court just said it would take the case last week.
But it's hard not, I think it's hard not to read something into it, right? Saying that, well, why this case, which is such a clear violation. I mean, it's that, you know, they teed it up specifically for that. And you got to feel that at least if they just wanted to let the precedent stand, they just would have not taken the case. But as you pointed out, it only takes four justices to decide to hear a case. So that to me suggests that at least four justices are ready to make some modifications to that sort of pre-viability dividing line. And I think you'll probably agree with me here. I think that's really important because if the court modifies in any way that kind of fetal viability line, if you will, what then is the limiting principle? You know, at what point then does the state's interest in preserving life or potential life become greater than a woman's right to control her own body? And I think at that point, you really grasp at any kind of a real limiting principle except for, well, life begins at conception, and so therefore the state's interest begin. You see what I'm saying here?
Well, I think the limiting principle then is whatever the state legislatures are going to create.
Got it. Okay.
Right? There'd be nothing to say that, you know, the court could rule you do not have a constitutional right to a pre-viability abortion. Of course, your state may provide it.
Right. So what you would be saying there is that essentially that there is no constitutionally protected right for a woman to terminate an unwanted pregnancy at any point.
Well, it depends on how the court rules. That is one route they could take.
I mean,
right?
Exactly.
Now keep in mind, like, look, in Roe, pregnancy was divided up into trimesters. No real reason one way or the other than that was just the, you know, how they decided to divide it up. In Casey, they came back with the little more scientific view of viability, which, again, it's a hazy line, but as you point out, it's around 24 months. Could the court draw some other line that is arbitrary or hazy, or maybe not arbitrary? Maybe there is some sensible line that they can draw. I don't know. One route would be to say, as you said, there is no constitutional right to constitutional right to abortion. Except, you know, under these, probably some of the exceptions that are included in the Florida statute or the Mississippi statute.
I wonder, Jay, though, if that's, I want to kind of not really push back, but like question you on the formulation of that, because oftentimes it's formulated as a constitutional right to abortion. And certainly we've both read the Constitution many times, and there is no direct stated constitutional right to abortion. But there's
right.
also
that's the problem.
but there's also no constitutional right to do all sorts of things that we accept as sort of standard privacy rights. There's no constitutional right to that the state can't say prohibit masturbation or something like that in private, obviously not in public. Decency thing, you know, that there, you could do that, but
is that
going to
be part of the platform,
saying?
Senator?
No, yeah. but you see what I'm saying here. I mean, it's a question of, well, is there even a generalized privacy right? So it's really
a
two-part.
I mean,
that's what I'm saying.
That's I mean, a good question, and that's another route the court could take, because right, the way Roe evolved was out of a case called Griswold, which had to do with birth control, which grew out of a case, and I'm forgetting the name of it now, but it had to do with whether or not you could speak German at home. And there, the court found that there is, you know, lurking in the Constitution, in the penumbras of the Constitution, these other rights, and one is a right to privacy, and the right to privacy was then applied to contraception, and then that was then expanded to include abortion. So, yeah, is there a right to privacy? That's a little bit of a, not a little bit, a completely a judicial creation. And so, for example, for our listeners who, I don't know, who care about these things, and maybe this is getting a little into the weeds, sort of one of the most infamous Supreme Court cases of all time was Lochner versus New York. Mike, you know all about that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And so in Lochner was a baker in New York, and New York passed this wage and hour regulations for bakers. And he said, hey, I've got a, damn it, this is America. I've got a right to contract and have whatever contracts I want. And the court found that, yeah, there is a liberty of the contract in the Constitution. Now, again, there's not really any provision you can point to. It was just kind of, well, it's kind of sort of there if you squint. And Justice Holmes, in his dissent, a very famous dissent on this, said, look, the Constitution doesn't adopt any particular economic theory. And this is, you know, this came to be known as Lochnerizing, where you just sort of find a right out there. And it was sort of the height of judicial activism. And that was in the 1920s. And then, Lochner, I don't believe, has ever been officially technically overruled. It has been probably the most highly criticized case in Supreme Court history, except maybe for Roe versus Wade.
Dred Scott.
But it gets back to that same idea using substantive due process to sort of create rights that are maybe kind of sort of there in the Constitution, but you can't identify exactly from whence they flow.
So do you? I mean, you've read the Constitution more than a few times, and you've thought about this sort of stuff for years. Do you think that there exists a privacy right in the Constitution, or and I want to be clear here, this is not to say that either way, and I think this is part of the problem with this.
Is this like my judicial confirmation hearing?
Well, I mean, I guess the reason I'm asking this is because...
First renounce Trump, now is the right to privacy.
I mean, seriously, do you think that there is a right to privacy in the Constitution? And I want to point out, this is what I was getting to before, the way you answer this doesn't necessarily mean that you're pro or anti-privacy. You could certainly argue
right.
that there is no right to privacy in the Constitution, but that there should be one, there should be an amendment, or that legislative bodies should protect privacy and not pass laws that invade privacy. And so I just wanted to kind of put that out there in front so that when people heard what I think might be your answer, they don't go, oh my God, Jay just hates women, basically. I don't know.
So no, and I apologize. Again, it's Friday afternoon, and that's maybe not the best time for us to record. there is a case, and it escapes me right now. But we're talking about substantive process, and what it sort of says is there are these other rights of substantive process that are inherent in ordered liberty, right? So I do think there is some privacy component in the Constitution, and you don't necessarily have to squint to find it all the time, because Fourth Amendment, right? I think there's that sort of explicitly deals with privacy, your right to be secure in your home and your papers and all that,
right?
The Fifth Amendment, due process, basic clause of due process of law. I think there is something, I think you can read some privacy components there. The sense of, is there a right to abortion, and when is this privacy right? Is it paramount? And let me put it this way. Maybe the better question is it a fundamental right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
because in Supreme Court parlance, there's what we call fundamental rights. And then there are other rights, and is it this fundamental constitutional? I don't know that it is. And again, as you said, that doesn't mean, well, maybe it shouldn't be. Yeah. Maybe there should be an amendment, or maybe it's protected by a state constitution, or you could have it protected by a state statute.
And I wonder,
Jay. I do think there is sort of in that inherent and ordered liberty piece. You know, there is sort of a sense of you have a right to be left alone.
Yeah, and that's why, I mean, I wonder if when we don't know, if it makes sense to err on the side of individual liberty.
Well, and with a lot of individual liberty questions, though, that it's also the cost to the rest of society is not as high as it is an abortion. So, for example, the case that I'm blanking. Somebody versus Kansas or Nebraska or somewhere out there, where they didn't want people speaking German at home. Mm-hmm. In that case, you could say, well so what? If people speak German at home, who cares? How does that affect burden any other right or burden society or the country? Likewise, in Griswold, if you want to say birth control, well, I suppose some people might have religious objections, but if those people have religious objections, well, they can, again, live their own lives. And the fact that someone else uses birth control doesn't particularly impose any restriction on them or prevent them from living their faith. But when you get to abortion, and there is, and you may disagree with me, but I think you have to argue there is an interest of an unborn person.
Sure.
And you can assign that interest different values, right? I mean, mm-hmm. some people say it's a child, life begins at conception, others less so. And at this point, the Supreme Court says, well, that right to life kicks in and trumps that individual liberty when you reach viability. So I think that's a key difference in abortion cases versus other privacy right cases.
Yeah.
Right. Because in other privacy right cases, the cases you're necessarily doing something that is private. and, right. and is not going to affect someone else, or, you know, or is very unlikely to infect someone else.
Right, which is why plenty of people would, I mean, in a very different area, argue about, you know, someone's right to say not wear a mask or not get vaccinated. Well, that's not a, just an individual choice of what to right. do with your body. There are potential other effects, and even more so here, because we know that there is a potential life, and the further on in the pregnancy, the more that potential life, or that life becomes a actuality of a life, you know, after viability. So I do think there is that fundamental right, and I think it's just a very difficult balancing. And I really feel like that the court more or less got it right with that sort of viability marker. That seems to me to be a reasonable limiting principle. But my sense of things is that the court wouldn't have taken this case if there weren't five justices who wanted to at least chip away in a significant way at this principle. And that's what I expect to happen. So that should be, I think that should have either way. I think when that decision comes out, and it will, like I said, probably in the summer of 2022, that should definitely have some pretty major political ramifications, that's for sure.
What would you agree, though, and again, this is setting aside feelings on the issue of abortion, on the moral issue, right or wrong, and when life begins and so forth. But from a purely constitutional standpoint, I mean, doesn't Roe look a whole lot like Lochner?
Well, I'd need to look over Lochner again, but I see what you're saying in the sense of.
Well, I mean, just in the general, Yeah. Okay, so the speaking German case was Meyer versus Nebraska.
There you go. Okay. Yeah.
So, yeah.
I should have known that one too. I've taught these things, but it was a million years ago. They don't let me teach con law anymore. I don't know why. But anyway, I know what you're saying, but just because it's not an enumerated right doesn't mean it's not a fundamental right. I guess. Yeah. And
so,
the stakes
so there's another,
so high and, go ahead.
There's another path out there. And again, this is sort of early in the, you know, stage to talk about this, but something else the court can do is they can say, look, we think that Roe was probably wrongly decided, but there has now arisen such an interest, in a reliance interest, that it would be imprudent for us to overturn the decision, right?
Boy,
it's sort of the stare decisis that in this case, even if a decision was incorrectly decided, we're going to let it go because so many people have relied on it to this point, but no further, right?
I would be... I see what you're saying. I would be surprised if the court did that, but I think that for those of us who believe that there is this fundamental right for a woman to terminate an unwanted pregnancy prior to viability, I think that's probably the best we can hope for.
I mean, to me, that's where I see like Justice Roberts coming down.
I could see him coming down on that, but I also could see him being on
the floor. Yeah, Roe was wrongly decided. It's really not a fundamental right, but you know what? This is where we are, and we're not going to overturn precedent.
Yeah, and previously that would have put him on the what I would consider the right side of a 5-4 decision on the majority side, but I think in this court that might actually put him in the minority.
Yeah. Well, the other thing to think about is there's unlikely to be. I don't think this is going to be a 6-3 decision, right? There's going to be patching together. It's going to be a 3-3-3 decision, or a, you know, it's going to be, I don't see it, you know, or maybe even a 1-1-1, you know, I don't see it, being a simple majority, and then minority opinion. I think it'll be more like Casey, where you're patching a holding together out of different pieces of what justices can agree on.
Yeah, that sounds right. So we should have, it should be all kinds of fun to read through all of that. And I am sure that at some point next summer, we will be spending a lot of time talking about that.
So can I throw in one last question on that?
You sure can.
And this is just a hypothetical.
Yeah.
Assuming the court overturns Roe versus Wade and says something to the effect of the federal constitution does not provide a constitutional right to pre-viability abortion. check with your local state constitution or state legislature. Does that lower the temperature on the Supreme Court and in Supreme Court nominations going forward? If the one big thing that, we've been fighting over for 40 years, the biggest thing we've been fighting over for 40 years, is gone.
No, not at all. I don't think. I think that there'll be even more of a push on the left to expand the court or change the court in some way to get the court to recognize a fundamental right, because I think that's at the crux of it, because plenty of people, including, I'm one of these people, believe that this isn't a question that can be or should be decided by Democratic majorities, because it is about a fundamental right. And that's the whole point of having these fundamental rights, is they cannot be taken away by simply because some majority in some state wants to take them away. And so that's why I don't think that would really have much of an effect. That's my sense.
Okay.
So we shall see. Certainly it'll be there'll be a lot to talk about then. All right. Well, that pretty much does it for us with today's show. But I did want to let folks know, if you're with us at this point, over an hour in, you are an Arden fan. Thank you so much. But I want to let you know, longtime listeners might remember a while back, Jay, you might remember this. We had this goal of getting 5% of listeners to support the show on Patreon. Does that sound familiar?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Well, at the time I announced it, this was more than a year ago, we were at like not quite 2.5%. And I kind of forgot about it. COVID and life intervened, you know, that kind of thing. But I looked just yesterday, and as of yesterday, we are only 23 Patreon supporters away from that 5% goal.
Wow.
And you know, 5% might not sound like much, because I mean, after all, it means that 95% of everyone who listens isn't supporting the show. But in the podcasting world, this actually is a pretty big deal. Because, you know, you can get this for free. And so you're supporting something you can get for free. And I really think that the fact that we're this close demonstrates just how incredibly supportive everyone who's listening now is, and how much you really care about what we try to do every single week on the show. And so first off, I want to just thank you for that. That means an awful lot. But also, I really want us to hit that 5% goal now that I know we're so close. So here's what we're going to do. If we get the 5%, those 23 more supporters by the end of June, we'll release not one, not two, but three extra bonus shows over the course of the summer. And the content of these shows, yeah, I know, it's crazy. I've gone crazy, Jay.
Robert Mapplethorpe tote bag or the Abortion Yes coffee mug, your choice of premiums.
But here's the thing, the content of these shows, it'll be decided by a vote of our Patreon supporters. So whatever you decide you want us to talk about, we will do three shows over the course of the summer on that. And that will be in addition to the regular midweek bonus show that, you know, all everyone who's a Patreon supporter gets every single Wednesday. So I think we can do it. I hope we can. I'll be interested in seeing what listeners want us to do for bonus shows. I think it should be, it should be pretty interesting. So, yeah. But that is it for this episode. On our bonus show, Jay and I are going to be talking about Ohio's vaccine lottery and other things that states have been doing. There you go. Yeah, me too. I registered. Also, Joe Manchin, his letter with, help me out here, I was going to say Arizona, not Arizona, but Alaska, it's an A, Senator Lisa Murkowski, about wanting to renew the Voting Rights Act and how that might play out. And also, we'll do our annual Tax Day segment, which we've done, I think, every year since we started the show, and I have some thoughts on taxes and progressivism, and maybe some things that'll be surprising. I don't know. We will see. But all of that is going to be on our bonus show, and maybe even some listener questions if we have time for that. And again, if you're a Patreon supporter, that will be there for you Wednesday morning. If you're not, just go to patreon.com/politicsguys and sign up to become a supporter and get us to that 5% goal. And if you'd like to hear that weekly bonus show, but you cannot afford to support the show, totally get that. Email me, mike@politicsguys.com, and I will get that all set up for you. Finally, again, you know, I say this every week, but it matters every week. Subscribing to the show, leaving ratings and reviews, and sharing your favorite episodes really does make a big difference, and it's absolutely free, so we would really appreciate that. A special thanks to our executive producers, Bruce Johnson, Wilma Moreno, Andra Masker, Daniel Toe, Chris Wilkerson, Nathan Sosnowski, and Ryan Beasley. We'll be back with a new show next week. We hope you'll join us.